But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show, where we discuss the key topics shaping the UK wealth management industry and investors' portfolios. I'm Sophie Downs and I'm joined today by James Sullivan, Head of Partnerships at Tyndall Investment Management. Welcome to the podcast, James.
Pleased to be here.
So let's unpack your role a bit. So you're Head of Partnerships. For anyone who isn't familiar with Tyndall, what does that entail day to day?
The title itself is a bit of a misnomer. It's sort of head of multi-asset, really, is the practicalities of my role. Partnerships is because we typically partner with IFA firms. We work very closely, collaboratively with IFA firms, and we build them a suite of model portfolios to suit their client bank and to suit their business. So it's much more bespoke, collaborative, hence the term partnership. And I manage that team and that proposition within Tyndall.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really keen to get into kind of what you're seeing in terms of what IFAs are telling you, any insights. But before that, let's stay focused on your role. So you've been at Tyndall for over 5 years now.
Yep.
How has kind of your role evolved from, because you came in, didn't you, in a building phase. So what does that look like now, kind of balancing that mature franchise?
Yeah, so more broadly within Tyndall, I think I joined in, as you say, 2020, I think it was. There were about 10 of us and a couple of fund managers, a couple of guys on the private client team. And I had proposed to Alex Odd, who's the chief exec and he was the founder of the business, that we could develop out this partnerships proposition, this multi-asset solution that was IFA focused. And it caught Tyndall at a good time. They thought that'd be a great sort of complementary proposition to what they already had on the fund and the private client team. And the business has grown over those 5 years from a headcount of about 10 to about 50 today, close to 50 today. We've now got two or three offices, the main office still here in Westminster. And in terms of AUM, we've grown from probably something like 100 million when I started, and we're just over 2 billion now. So it's still a very small business relative to our peer group, but we're moving in the right direction.
And of course, you started your career in fund management.
Yeah.
How does that kind of impact your ability to do this role?
It's the same but different. So I was running multi-asset funds. Clearly, that's a product. It's unitized. What we've done really is just unbundle that, and we deliver it to the IFA client in a much more bespoke manner. And instead of just having one fund, you clearly have a range of models along the risk spectrum. What I absolutely love about my job today that didn't necessarily sort of play out when I was more of a fund manager is the relationship management element of my role, going and seeing my clients. And certainly not just in London. You know, we've got a lot of clients in various regions across the UK, and sitting down with them and just talking markets and talking about the industry. And that's part of my job that I enjoy immensely.
Mm. Where are the kind of the bulk of your partners' firms located?
It's random. You know, we've got clients in sort of Leicester, Spalding. We've got some in the Southwest. We've got clients in Belfast, Cardiff, Newcastle, York, and we do have a couple in Dorset in London. So it's a real smorgasbord of layout of client, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how do you tailor the proposition you offer depending on the location of a partner?
I don't really think about it. I think if we do tailor anything, it might just be the way we deliver a presentation or engage with the client. The sort of the proposition and the product itself is broadly the same, but it might just be the way we engage with the audience. And it's not always just the IFA. Sometimes they have clients involved, or the clients might be on a webinar and we'd be talking to them. And just small things, like if we're up north, we might be talking more about rugby league than we are talking about rugby union. Just small sort of nuances and subtleties. But I would say broadly, it comes back to knowing your audience and knowing your client and giving them what we believe to be is engaging commentary and personality.
Mm-hmm. Now, you last joined us in 2024 to talk about the MPS market. So the narrative then was very much this kind of race to the bottom. We're talking a lot about how it's becoming an increasingly saturated market. nearly two years on, where are we now?
It does feel like it's plateaued a little bit. Mm. I think when we did sit down 2 years ago, we were in the eye of a storm. You know, AMCs were falling and tumbling. And I think there was a general sort of concern. We weren't sure where they were going to sort of end up. It does feel like over the last sort of 18 months or so, we've broadly flatlined in terms of where the bottom line is for charging for an MPS proposition. I think what's been good for us is the consumer duty legislation. And it's become apparent that more IFAs, perhaps than before, are looking for a solution that adds value to their clients and their business. And that means they're going down the route of adopting an MPS partner, potentially like Tyndall, who deliver a bespoke service, a bespoke suite of models just for that IFA firm, white labeled fact sheets and literature. And of course, their own investment committee typically held at their office or a location of their choice. And I think that just helps signify they're going above and beyond, and they're not simply buying a product off the shelf. And that's been good for us, but we have also seen the rise of other bespoke MPS providers at the same time to capture that area of growth.
Mm. I'm intrigued to hear your thoughts on this, because from my perspective, it seems that everyone now claims to offer these kind of tailored solutions. I mean, firstly, how accurate is that? Are people really delivering what they say they are?
I don't know. what I do hear a lot is firms trying to develop a mass bespoke, you know, so it's trying to roll out something on a bespoke manner, but still have it as a product, a centralized proposition. I think that's very difficult to achieve. And I was presenting the other week and I'd explained that I'd hosted over 50 investment committees over the last 12 months in different regions. And somebody says, does that not make your proposition unsustainable? And I turned it on its head and I said, actually, our proposition would be unsustainable if we didn't host 50 odd investment committees a year, because that's what we need to do to make it a genuine proposition that is genuinely bespoke and adds value to IFA firms. So I think firms that are not necessarily abiding by, you know, the bespoke nature of the articulation of the proposition, at some point it'll come back to haunt them. Mm. But finding a solution to a bespoke product that can grow in a linear manner is difficult. I think we just have to expect and accept that we'll have to inject more costs, infrastructure and staff into the proposition and the team as we grow to cater for the next wave of clients that we may or may not be lucky enough to onboard.
Mm. As someone who builds these yourself, where does standardized MPS end and a true partnership begin?
Where does it end and where does it begin? I think it's a really good question. I, if we had a Venn diagram of the two propositions, there's probably a big bit in the middle. And I'm not sure where the articulation is of bespoke versus standardized. All I know is that clients typically want personality, they want accountability, they want to see somebody front up and own the performance and the process and be in their office once every 3 months or 6 months and explain to them what they're doing and why they're doing it. That doesn't typically come with an off-the-shelf MPS, or if it does, it's delivered by a product specialist or a relationship manager, not the fund manager or the MPS manager, the person who's actually responsible for sort of pulling the trigger and deciding on asset allocation. Mm-hmm. So I suspect it's a degree of full accountability and transparency and a bespoke articulation of the service to each particular IFA.
I mean, that point about personality is always is really interesting. And actually, when you came and joined us in your last interview 2 years ago, you did argue that model portfolios at the time needed more personality. I mean, firstly, have we delivered on this since? But also, I'd be interested to, what does the personality look like within that?
So have we delivered on it since in terms of an industry? I think increasingly so.
Okay.
There are still some very, very big plain vanilla MPS providers out there. It doesn't make them wrong or bad. There's clearly a demand for an off-the-shelf proposition. But as I said earlier, there's also an increasing demand for an MPS proposition that's trying to do something different. And the personality, I still think, resides with the person that's fronting up the investment committees, and whether that be myself or some of my colleagues. when we get asked a lot about whether AI is going to steal our job, and it's relevant to all aspects of the financial services industry, of course, the IFAs themselves also, the one sort of common denominator that is going to sort of protect our jobs to a degree is that personality, is that accountability, is that ability to sort of drive or fly 2 or 3 hours to be in an office in the north and front up and explain to clients what we're doing and why we're doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, clients still want to see somebody own the process and own the performance.
How are clients feeling? Because, I mean, you speak to IFAs, you must get a sense of their priorities, what things are troubling them, perhaps. Obviously, the topic on everyone's lips is tech and is AI. How are they feeling around this? Is there excitement? Is there trepidation? What are you saying?
Yeah, both of those. I think there is a degree of anxiety. I've spoken to some, not just younger advisors, but younger people in our industry who worry about the longevity of their role. They think, have I got another 30 years worth of, you know, salary coming in if I stay doing what I'm doing? So I think there are an increasing number that are looking to pivot towards something a little bit different to create genuine or additional value for their clients. Because you rightly identified, there's also a younger end client who is now very happy to go online and ask Claude or Chat or Copilot, you know, what is my optimum portfolio? I think the role of the IFA is still integral to the smooth running of the financial services industry. It's the sort of the oil within the cogs, and certainly the interface between at times a very vulnerable end client and the asset management industry and the DFM industry. You know, the IFA industry that sits in the middle is playing a pivotal role in ensuring positive outcomes for clients.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose it's also a role that, you know, we talk about M&A all the time. But if we've identified, you know, maybe AI as a pressure point potentially, I think we've got to talk about the role of M&A in the industry. I mean, firstly, coming from Tyndall, how would you speak to the benefits of a boutique?
When I first joined Tyndall, this is probably the easiest way to address the question. When I joined Tyndall 5 years ago, it was a relatively small business, or it was a small business, and it's still relatively small. The reason I joined personally is because I thought I could make a difference. I wanted to be able to work for a firm where my contribution counted towards something. And I would suggest that is that's apparent within everybody else who works at Tyndall. So it breeds a type of work ethic and in ethos and the whole value culture type of conversation. So I think typically one gets a different type of person, an employee at a boutique than a huge, you know, investment bank. It doesn't always lead to better outcomes, but I think it's a different culture. But it is tough. You know, the cost of compliance and regulatory oversight typically only goes up, and it goes up with the right intentions. I understand why the FCA imposed more and more legislation upon us. But it does mean that we have to continue growing just to stand still from a cost perspective. That's not always easy. And I was talking to your colleague Dylan in the foyer. The other recurring issue for boutiques isn't necessarily the size of the boutique. It's the vintage. So we were set up 10, 12 years ago. We have some shareholders. We're very lucky to have incredibly supportive shareholders at Tyndall. But everybody has a right to occasionally ask for some money back within a private unlisted company. It's that cycle, it's that next cycle as to how a business of our size refinances itself every 12 or 15 years to ensure that, you know, original investors get looked after. And that typically takes a boutique up through the sort of the growth phase, because it also leads to potentially an injection of capital with another growth strategy. So it's exciting to be a part of a boutique. You don't stand still, that's for sure.
Is there a balance then of you know, being so proud of the boutique heritage and proud of the culture, whilst also maintaining that want and need really to grow? Where's the line? Where's the balance there?
So I personally don't get too hung up on boutique and what it represents. All I know is I want to work for a business that has got really, really good values. I still want to be able to come into work every day thinking I've got the best job in the world. And if we're growing and we're moving in the right direction, you know, that's the optimum place to be. And I don't personally care if we're going from 2 billion to 5 or 5 to 15. A boutique is just a badge that we give ourselves or individuals give us. I just want to work for a business that carries those attributes and those characteristics of being on the front foot and growing.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested to hear your thoughts. I mean, a common industry view I hear, and you often see it all over LinkedIn, is this idea that with the dawn of M&A and with it scaling up, what we're going to see is this kind of squeezed middle, where middle-sized firms might struggle in a place where, you know, you've got very specialist boutiques and these kind of huge giants on the other end. You know, I guess what would your perspective on that be?
Yeah, that's been talked about for quite some time, and I always find it quite interesting because I'm not sure I always totally agree with it. You know, we see a lot of mid-tier asset managers in the UK. You know, we can name two or three of them, the Jupiters and the Artemis, Lion Trust, Mitan. And there's been talk for years that they'll be bought because they're too small, and yet they're still here, you know, serving clients as they always have done. I'm not sure the end client is necessarily wedded to any one particular sort of size of business. I don't think the size of the business really influences the end client's decision when it comes to investing.
Mm-hmm.
So I am aware that regulatory pressures are a thing, and whether you're small, medium or large, they come with very, very similar burdens. It's very easy to suggest it's hard being small,
but
I'd rather be small and growing than be a huge company that is mature and is rolling over when it comes to sort of product cycle. You know, we see very few large UK-based asset managers at the top of their game that are continuing to grow. You know, they're treading water, and they're really defending on the downside.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's quite a refreshing view to hear. You know, maybe that narrative is slightly overblown, perhaps. How do you see it playing out over the next maybe decade?
Mm.
If, you know, M&A continues, but we also see the benefits of these smaller firms, how might that play out?
I think within the asset management industry, it might be slightly different to, say, the DFM and the MPS space. I think in the MPS space and potentially the DFM space, we might continue to see consolidation. I don't think asset managers at the moment are in great demand.
Mm.
You know, we're not seeing private equity come in and buy UK asset managers. We've certainly seen it with the advisory businesses. We're now seeing it to a degree with MPS and DFM. The asset managers are not commanding the type of premium that they once did. And therefore, I think M&A within the asset management space is likely to be few and far between. You know, we saw a deal early this year, late last year, Lion Trust bought Martin Gilbert's business. So I think we're going to see sort of small bolt-on acquisitions. I think that's going to happen all the time. I'm just not sure we're going to see the likes of a Standard Life and Aberdeen type of deal again anytime soon.
Well, let's pivot slightly. I mean, within this changing environment, what would your kind of top survival tips be for an IFA who may be struggling to navigate it?
You know, it's really tough out there. And I was speaking to a young IFA at a conference last week. He had just started up. He just got his qualifications. And my question to him was, how do you go out and actually build a client bank? And he said, it's brutal. It's really hard. Networking, word of mouth. I'm going to every single conference there is. I'm getting out and about. I know that necessarily wasn't the angle of the question, but that's one aspect of where IFAs are potentially struggling to get traction, is building that client base, because the younger audience, as I said earlier, they're more willing to adopt an AI approach or a low-cost tech solution. At the upper end, one of the struggles, again, as we touched upon, are IFAs of a certain vintage just struggling a little bit with how to bring AI into the business that doesn't replace them and their revenue. But I think what they would also find is that the alignment they have with their clients are also of a certain demographic. They don't want to be dealing with AI and technology. They still want those touch points. You know, the similar to why certain individuals sort of quite enjoy going to see their GP. It's comforting to go and talk through with somebody rather than simply Google, you know, what disease have I got or what's wrong with me? We still like that accountability. We still like, you know, being able to, you know, sit down with somebody over a cup of tea and sort of put the world to rights.
So AI won't be replacing that human element anytime soon?
Around the fringes, but not in the main.
Well, that sounds like quite a nice note to end it on, I think. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Been a pleasure.
Well, that's all we have time for today. We'll see you next week.
Today is VE Day. The war is over.
The crown queen wave. waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.